On this episode of the Cloud Native Application Flows podcast, Sebastian and I are joined by Jack Chester, the author of Knative in Action. Jack is a former engineer for Pivotal and VMware, and he now works for Shopify. We hope you enjoy this conversation about writing the book on Knative, the history of Cloud Foundry versus Kubernetes, and the underappreciated beauty of build packs. I'm joined today by Jack Chester, and just to get started, I'd like to ask you the question: Is there a technology that you love that nobody else does?
Well, I'll say that love is a strong word, but I think Java gets a bad rap. It works. It's pretty functional. I miss generics sorely whenever I'm using Golang. I miss static typing whenever I'm using Ruby. So I think Java's got a lot going for it.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is I don't think Java's going away. So
no, I think it's here to stay, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's still everywhere in the enterprise, definitely.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's why we have containers taking, 30 minutes, an hour to start because of the JVM starting.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, you could do some cool things with JVMs, and I guess there's not really like a hosted JVM container that can run other containers on top of your containers. Not yet. So somebody's working on that probably.
No doubt.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about how you got to here, to talking to us today. Can you give us like a quick walkthrough of, some of your career highlights and what brought you your internet fame today?
Internet fame. Hanging around on the internet for a very long time is a big part of my internet fame, just sheer longevity. And also getting really good at comments that sound intelligent and insightful, but are also slightly infuriating. That makes me really good at playing Hacker News as a game. I score pretty well there. The thing that sort of led me career-wise, I started off by working a series of fairly minor kind of jobs. I don't want to be too dismissive, so I won't name them. The tech scene in Australia is somewhat limited. Certainly it was limited in the part of Australia that I was in, which is Perth, Western Australia.
Okay. I currently live in Sydney, but I've been to Perth 4 or 5 times. So
yeah. Perth's nice.
Yeah, it's lovely.
I'm not gonna knock Perth. It's just that some places have more of an industry than other places. If you're really passionate about mining, Perth is a great city. There's a lot of activity going on. There's groups, there's people to meet, there's a network you can build. There's the equivalent of startups and venture capital, everything. There's a whole ecosystem, a lot like the Bay Area, but for mining. Unfortunately, I'm not a huge fan of digging stuff out of the ground. Personally, I appreciate that other people are interested by it. So I started off in Perth and I had a couple of these jobs, and I also did some work in Darwin, which is my hometown, a small city up the top of the middle of Australia for those who want to win the pub trivia contest tomorrow.
I've been there too. And,
yeah. See, you've been everywhere, man.
Yep.
It is. I love Darwin. So I did that for a while. And then I had saved up some money and decided, one of these days, I'll move to that exciting, big wide world of the United States to do a job. One day when I'm good enough, right? I'm not good enough to get a job there, but I'd saved some money. So I went for a holiday and I decided to do some practice interviews. I thought I'll do some practice interviews. I'll find out what I suck at and I'll get better at that and come back. And then Pivotal spoiled my plan by offering me a job.
Way to go, Pivotal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, how dare they?
Yeah.
I wound up moving to New York, working for Pivotal Labs to start with. And so that's the consulting side of what was Pivotal. I was there for about 2.5 years and I switched to the R&D side, the product side of Pivotal, which is just called Pivotal. I was mostly focused on Cloud Foundry or Cloud Foundry teams. And then when the acquisition happened, by the time the acquisition happened, which was VMware taking over Pivotal, I had started work on the book. I'd been at Pivotal and I'd been approached by Manning to write the book. And I had talked to my managers and sort of said, look, I want to do this. And they said, oh, you should take some work time to do it. I said, yes, I agree.
that's always nice. So why did Manning approach you? you know, were you, you know?
I've been very careful not to ask in case I have to correct them. Okay. I'm happy with the illusion that they thought I could do it. And it was funny. I talked to the acquisition editor and I said, you know, if I do this, I'm crazy. And he said, if you don't do it, you're crazy.
Yeah.
So you're kind of stuck coming and going.
So are you happy you wrote the book? Are you happy to have had the experience to write it?
I'm happy I wrote a book. I'm happy I wrote that book. I'm happy that I got a chance at like an unusually easy, relatively speaking, opportunity to do it. Most people who write books for computer science or software engineering or programming have to do it in their own time. And I cannot imagine it because I was working on it basically full time for about a year is about how long it took to do it. And it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
It was just a ton of work.
What is the Manning, format? Is that a Word document or is it, you know, ASCII doc, or I'm just curious.
Yeah, they have a couple of options. ASCII doc is the one I chose. They also do Word and Google Docs is the third option. Okay. So I chose ASCII doc because I could, you know, put it in source control.
Yeah, yeah. So I, you know, when I wrote the Kubernetes cookbook, Docker cookbook with, you know, O'Reilly, it was just all ASCII doc and they have this nice build system. So you actually just, you know, commit and push ASCII doc and automatically builds the book. You can see it render, you know, continuously. So that was actually relatively painless.
Yeah. They provided me like a style sheet for ASCII doctor, I think it was. So it could show you approximately what the final printout would look like. Like not exactly. They still go through a production process to do the final layout, but you got a pretty good idea of what it was going to look like. The thing that probably surprised me most in that process was some colors not coming out very well in grayscale. Mm-hmm. So I had to amend a bunch of diagrams and also making sure that the diagrams fit, because they had a limit on how big they could be. So I had to sort of constantly be aware of how many inches I had to work with. Yeah. And it wasn't many.
Yeah. Hey, can I ask a question about Cloud Foundry? Do you mind? Mm-hmm. So when I talk a little bit about the history of Kubernetes and that it comes from Borg, you know, I always mention that, you know, 12-factor application principles and so on, kind of, you know, saw the light of day at Google, and that Cloud Foundry was actually inspired also by Borg as one of the paths or the one of the systems that they use to kind of manage applications. So is that correct? And is that correct that Derek Collison was the creator of Cloud Foundry?
My understanding is the oral history that I have imbibed from various people is yes. Borg was one of the inspirations, particularly of the deployment system Bosch. The other inspiration is, as it were, like the other mind parent would be Heroku in terms of developer experience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Derek Collison was one of the founding architects and his influence is still felt through the presence of NATS, which is used, I think, in routing still. A lot of other places it got replaced by other approaches. But as much as he deserves credit for being one of the founding visionaries, there is an enormous amount of work from an enormous number of very smart people which was necessary to bring Cloud Foundry to fruition, to the sort of the mature, battle-tested, hardened, enterprise grade, all these other positive adjectives.
Yep.
Takes an enormous amount of work. You know, architecture is important, but the most perfect architecture still needs to meet the ground.
Yeah. And you know, when I look at, you know, I really like to understand technology in the, you know, historical and, you know, evolution context. So when we look at Cloud Foundry, which definitely had a huge success in the enterprise, right? I remember, you know, talking to folks at some point that were saying, "Oh, we have Cloud Foundry, you know, in the company. We don't want to move to Kubernetes." Or, you know, "We have Cloud Foundry and yes, we are moving to Kubernetes and we're going to switch and so on." What happened between those two systems that are actually quite different? One is much more application centric. One is much more, you know, to me, you know, low level, let's say low level application or even closer to the infrastructure. What happened with Cloud Foundry that kind of started making people think that they should replace it with something like Kubernetes?
I don't know that it was something that happened to Cloud Foundry per se. I think the movement of folks away from Cloud Foundry to Kubernetes was not so much that Cloud Foundry pushed them out. It was that Kubernetes created this ever-growing gravity that pulled people in. And a lot of that was down to broad spectrum marketing, essentially. So Cloud Foundry was born in the crucible of enterprise software companies. Pivotal was seeded with a great many people who had worked at large enterprise software companies and thought in terms of large enterprise software companies and targeted large enterprises for sales. So it was always born to deal with these large cases, and it was never seen as urgent to create mind share outside of the market that was being sold to. Whereas with Kubernetes, there was, so to speak, no market at first, right? It was a straight up, you know, land grab for developer mind share, you know, developer attention. And that's what created the groundswell that led to its dominance today.
They wanted to take it from you know, Docker and Mesosphere. The writing was on the wall, but the next, you know, containers were the future. It's just how you orchestrate them and manage them and, you know, get them into production. That's kind of that's what the fight was for.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, Pivotal was conceived, in my understanding, and Cloud Foundry was conceived with that exact hypothesis in mind, is that there was, so to speak, a third generation or a fourth generation of computing platform coming, that the size of such a market would be vast, and that it would be good to get in first. And it was very successful. It was just that there were things that came out of nowhere. Docker more or less came out of nowhere. For Cloud Foundry, the container implementation was an implementation detail. It wasn't seen as something that needed to be exposed. That was proved wrong. And Kubernetes had the advantage of being a second mover or a last mover. So it could take advantage of that as a surfacing that implementation detail and making it core to the user experience. Right. So there was a strong synergy between the two, whereas Cloud Foundry was still very much connected to a firm vision of the world that there was a developer experience and there was an operator experience, and they weren't fused in any way. They were distinct ways of talking to the system.
Right. I mean, the build pack, I guess, was the API the point of experience for where they met rather than at the container level.
The Cloud Native Application Flows podcast is brought to you by TriggerMesh. Built on Kubernetes and Knative, the TriggerMesh integration platform helps integrate data, events, and applications across cloud native and on-premises infrastructures. If you'd like to learn more about the TriggerMesh integration platform, please visit us at triggermesh.com. And now, back to the show.
So with Cloud Foundry, yes, the interface was at the source code. That was the relationship. In previous generations, the relationship had been more about the deployed artifact. And that meant it was different for everybody. You know, you had your Java jars, you had your executables with shell scripts to install them, you had your RPMs, everything was sort of slightly different. The nice thing about Cloud Foundry is it was like, well, there's always source code. No matter what the final artifact is, source code is always involved. So we might as well meet you at the source code, make that the surface. Containers turned out to be a fantastic mechanism of distribution. They too had a universalizing kind of ability that appealed to a lot of folks and had a lot of advantages over the RPMs and the devs and the jars of the world. And so most people had not been exposed to Cloud Foundry. Heroku had slowly settled into being more niche than it was initially. So people didn't think of Buildpax as their first port of call.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating because, you know, first, you know, what I'm hearing is, that Cloud Foundry was very large enterprise focused and designed, right? Whereas, you know, when later Kubernetes arrived and, you know, following on the footsteps of, you know, Docker, it was very much more of a, developer mindset and developer traction, you know, systems, right? Mm-hmm. So totally different angle of attacks. And now what I find fascinating is that, you know, the switch happened, you know, so people now are more Kubernetes with the gravity that you mentioned. But now people are like, hey, actually, you know, I don't need Kubernetes. I really would like a PaaS on top of Kubernetes. So they're going back to what Cloud Foundry was. And then the source code, I find that fascinating, you know, as well, because it's a big debate. When Lambda, you know, AWS Lambda showed up, and you know, you see source as being the surface. We had some discussion when we developed Kubeless, you know, a few years back, where, you know, are we going source code or are we going with the container as the artifact and the deployable, you know, unit, right? And we started thinking, you know, it's source. But then, you know, when you see things like Cloud Run and then container for Lambda, there is still that debate of, you know, what is the best? Should we do source code? Mm-hmm. Should we do, you know, container? And I actually think that, you know, companies are so good now with their CI/CD system that they can spit out containers, you know, like crazy.
That boundary became wider. Like there was originally, you know, it was side by side, cheek by cheek between the software and the place it was going to run, and having the build packs made that an incredibly smooth experience. CI/CD has grown into an institution in itself. It was still, when I started at Pivotal in 2014, I would say that CI had been thought of widely, but basically meant a few things in Jenkins. It hadn't yet evolved into the sort of the all-encompassing way of doing things that it has been today at more mature organizations. I still think, you know, there's a role for build packs in that world. They can still be the ones that produce that artifact. And I would argue that they can do a better job of it than most people dabbling. Everything that's hard about creating containers, and there is a surprising amount you need to know to do a really fast container, a safe container, is encoded for you. It's done for you. All you need to do is show up with source code.
So you think build packs are better than writing your Docker file by hand?
I would say that for the majority of use cases, yes.
Okay.
In the same way that for the majority of the time, if I'm running a computer game, I'm going to be using C++ and occasionally dropping down to assembler. But most of the time, I'm in a higher level language.
Mm-hmm. Because I've always been fascinating with build packs with the, you know, I mean, granted, I'm going to be honest, I've never used them. You know, maybe I spent a couple hours on them, but I'm always fascinated by this concept of detect, right? That here is my code. Mm-hmm. Hey, magically detect what I'm running, and somehow you can actually configure the, you know, the build and then the runtime to do things properly for me without me telling you almost, you know, zero information. Mm-hmm. So does that really work? Like the, yeah?
Yep. It really works. Yeah. It's like it takes a bunch of engineering to do that. You know, writing build packs is not easy.
No.
Using them is.
A bunch of the work has already been done. I mean, you were involved in the V2 spec and the V3 spec. So has it substantially changed, or, you know, was it, you know, pretty good 5 years ago and now it's just refinement?
So for the benefit of those listening, what usually gets called V2 was the sort of what people think of as historically as build packs, the experience you got with Heroku and the experience you got with Cloud Foundry, where you push some source code and some churning happened and out came a giant single image, essentially. Like it behaved very much like a single layer image, everything in one giant fat layer. Version 3, which is what now gets called cloud native build packs, was saying, we want to keep the user experience of just provide the source code and everything else gets taken care of, but also, there are all these interesting features, both in the container image format and in the container registry API, that allow us to do things that could not be done before, and also to do things that can't be done with Docker files. The really big example there is called layer rebasing, where you can swap a layer from underneath something very, very quickly. And so your rebuilds are very fast. That was important because the really big downside of version 2 build packs was that they created that single gigantic blob. And that single gigantic blob was slow to load, create a lot of network traffic, create a lot of disk churn, and you were constantly loading the same bits over and over. If you're in a large enterprise where you have Java apps, downloading the JVM over and over and over, just because you don't have an efficient way of sharing the layers, mm-hmm. was incredibly wasteful. Whereas now with the cloud native packs, they produce images, those images have layers, the layers can be cached. It's smart enough to make sure that everybody has the same JVM at the same time. And so you only have to download it once to each of the nodes.
So you did get some good ideas from Docker, the way the images are built, right?
Yeah. Once I'm not going to take credit for the V3 design. It was a joint effort by some really smart people who had really dug deeply. I'm going to call out Stephen Levine from Pivotal Now VMware and Joe Kuttner and Terrence Lee from Heroku as being real visionaries in terms of what could be done. And I apologize to anyone else I've left out. I had been noodling around the edges of container technology at the time, or sort of like Docker technologies at the time, because Pivotal had a growing interest in functions as a service, as a genre. And you know, whether this was something that was going to upset the apple cart for Cloud Foundry, right? Because there are things that were similar to what you might imagine as an ideal functions as a service sort of experience, but there were things that were different as well. And you know, what did that look like and how did it fit? And it was that experience of investigating that relationship between what you have at a platform as a service classically and what you have as a functions as a service sort of classically, so to speak.
Yep.
That led me to really get deep into the container technology stuff. So as soon as I saw those designs emerging from the people who are pioneering them, I could see, oh yes, this is the future. These are obvious in retrospect steps that have huge consequences for performance.
So why do you think, you know, from a community technology, you know, standpoint, why do you think that AWS with Lambda and then much later, you know, even Google with Cloud Run, why didn't they adopt build packs as kind of the default build and runtime, you know, system for their own FAS and container system?
I'll push back slightly. I'll say at least for Google. Google do support build packs. They do have a build pack pipeline essentially for Cloud Run.
Oh, okay.
You can click a button. Yeah, I can't remember what they call it. Something something for Cloud Run or Cloud Run something something. But essentially, it's like a push button experience. You hook up your repo and you press a button and ta-da! It does everything for you and it uses build packs. They actually maintain their own build packs that use the standard infrastructure, the lifecycle. With AWS, my joke about AWS is that AWS does not have not invented here syndrome. That would, first of all, suppose that they knew what not here means, and they don't. Like AWS is kind of like the Microsoft of our era in that it doesn't ignore standards for the hell of it. It just doesn't realize or care.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I found that really frustrating when they came out with Lambda layers. And I'm like, Cloud Native Build Packs have been out at this point for 2 years. And it's not as though we held that secret or anything. And you're re-implementing it, just not as well. Mm-hmm. And it was a very frustrating experience for me seeing that happen. So it's just like you build something that was not interoperable with the wider ecosystem. It's not as effective or efficient. Why? Why'd you do that?
Yeah. No need.
And sometimes it seems like they're not aware of their own efforts. You know, so you have different teams implementing the same sorts of functionality again and again.
Yeah. I mean, that's the curse of all large organizations is 16 right hands don't know what 17 left hands are up to.
It's a lot of pizza.
Yeah, exactly.
So if we fast forward a little bit, then we talk, you know, you talked about FAS, you know, the emergence of FAS. I mean, definitely all those function as a service system, you know, to me, they're on the spectrum of, you know, PaaS, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, you were there when, you know, so Pivotal did Riff and then there was Efficient and then I did Kubeless and there was OpenFaaS and OpenWhisk and so on. You know, I mean, without trying to be controversial, what do you think happened, you know, at that time when there were all those projects that ultimately led to the, you know, the creation of the Knative project?
I think it was a couple of things. One is that Kubernetes was not yet ready to be a true functions as a service substrate. And this continued into the light of Knative. So a classic example is network probes, which have a minimum resolution of 1 second. You want your functions to launch faster than a second, mm-hmm. right? So a 1 second network probe, you know, reveals the initial assumption of Kubernetes that what you were interested in was long running processes that had to be kept alive and recreated and monitored and so on, rather than ephemeral sort of like bursts of light here and there. That was sort of the first thing. And I think most FASs that elected to build on top of Kubernetes had that difficulty. You look at something like OpenWhisk, it was all from the ground up, or at least from Docker up. So they could be much more specific in the design. And there are things that OpenWhisk could do that probably I haven't checked, but probably you still can't do. So a very big example is that is being able to do a freeze on a process. You actually tell the kernel, this process is not going to run for a while, but I want you to keep it in RAM because I'm going to come back to it later. And you can rehydrate that process much faster than you could as versus doing a fork to reload it from disk or from swap. So in terms of what happened, I think basically Google was able to create the gravity that more or less decided which FAS was most likely to emerge from the field. And they had a lot of momentum and a lot of credibility because of their foundational role in Kubernetes. Like they had created this runaway phenomenon. And folks wanted to make sure that if they were to be involved in this market, that they would also be involved. Now, I should say that Pivotal didn't just, you know, roll on its back and kick its legs in the air and say, okay, I give up. We had a great deal of investment in examining existing functions as a service platforms. Project Riff had a bunch of novel features and capabilities, mm-hmm. And a particular focus that was not very widespread. And when Google approached Pivotal saying, look, we're working on this thing, we took our time to study it. Like we didn't just go, oh, okay, right? We wanted to make sure that it was the right decision sort of as a business, but also technologically, that it all held together, and it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's, you know, that's great. I mean, one of the, you know, technological, one of the views of Knative to me, which was interesting, is that indeed the artifact is really the container. So the service mm-hmm. object, you know, the base is really the container. So they didn't try to tackle the source to image, you know, workflow. There was a little bit of it, you know, in the documentation at the beginning. There was yeah. some mentions of it at the beginning, but right away the focus was really on the container is the deployable artifact. Give it to me, I'll give you the auto scaling. Why do you think that is, that Knative didn't really try to address the really source to image workflow?
In the early days it sort of did. There was this concept of build. Yeah. That was sort of embedded. One of the things that I and others at Pivotal argued was that the container was a really good crisp contact point between Knative and Kubernetes, and therefore, so to speak, with the outside world. And that if there is to be something that converts source code into a container, it shouldn't be embedded into the running definition. Mm-hmm. Right, it should be crisply defined as a standalone mm-hmm. thing. So for me, I mean, my ideal world is that you use build packs to do that. Other people will use Docker files with a variety of tools, not just Docker. There's Kaneko and Builder and others. And the other thing too was that the thing was that initially it was trying to be purely a function as a service, which is why it had that embedded build sort of experience. It's like meet them at the source code and go all the way to a running function. Without going through the container in the middle, at least not visibly. But what we sort of pointed out is that the primitives that are provided, if you put build to one side, are good for ephemeral functions. They're also good for long-running services, and that this improves the Kubernetes developer experience mm-hmm. for everyone, for across the board, not just for the ephemeral functions case. Later on, Pivotal Started working on KPAC, which you might have heard of, which is a sort of a standalone service that provides automated builds using build packs. It watches source code repos and it spits out images as soon as something new arrives. Mm-hmm. And that could give you the last mile, but you didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? You could use anything. And to your point earlier about CI/CD, it had greatly matured. The container had been the target of output and deployment. So it fit kind of neatly into that world.
Yeah. So what we've seen at TriggerMesh actually has been interesting is that first big enterprise, they have CI CD system in place, they can spit out containers, right? So they don't really need the build experience. They've learned how to do it, kind of themselves. So container as the deployable unit, makes sense. But then what surprised me relatively quickly is that for a lot of people, the scale to zero didn't really matter. They said, hey, it's interesting. I know Lambda gives me the scale to zero, but if I keep one pod running in my enterprise, I don't really care. So, autoscaler is fine, if it works well, but the scale to zero is not a massive feature. So that's why, we really concentrated on the eventing. We kind of took the build, the serving as one side, but then we really saw, serverless and integration as where at the key being really eventing, and that's where we focused on eventing. What are your thoughts about eventing, event driven applications in general and in the container space?
The first thing is that it's harder than it looks. Everyone discovers this. Either for the people implementing the infrastructure or platform on which that happens, but also people using it. One of the big dangers is the attraction for what I call dabs of glue, where you're like, I want to integrate these two systems. I'm just going to put like a dab of glue to stick them together. And that's going to be a function. Mm-hmm. And if you're not careful, that can turn into a sprawling mess of spaghetti, where you have many, many, many dabs of glue and you don't know where they came from or how they got there or who manages them. So it's all the sort of classic problems of microservices, but amplified. The second problem is that when you get into event-driven architectures, you gain certain capabilities in terms of flexibility and scalability and so on. Mm-hmm. But congratulations, you now own a distributed system and you have to care about Byzantine fault tolerance. You have to care about the dynamics of queues, which can be highly nonlinear depending on what's going on. You can have queues that are chugging along very happily, and then one day they're over capacity by just 1%, and suddenly they explode. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of complexity that comes from that. The other thing, too, is that I've found that folks have not, I suppose, to my satisfaction, and I sound like I'm sitting in judgment of the entire industry and that I'm qualified to, but there hasn't been a satisfaction of like this tension between what I call the differential or derivative view, which is lots of small changes or events saying this change from X to Y versus the integral view of what you would think of as a database, where it's a single structured sort of rolling snapshots rather than individual changes. And I gave a lot of thought to this because of my time on Project Riff. Riff had a conscious focus on streaming use cases. And a lot of architecture was oriented towards making streaming use cases more efficient. It's not obvious on the surface how to do that. It may seem obvious. Oh, just events. Just send events and pull them in one at a time. That's a stream. But then you get into that dynamics question again, the actual physics of how events move through your system. And you can say to somebody, look, from one point of view, it doesn't matter whether my package arrives in a truck, in a box, one at a time, or whether I get a conveyor belt directly into my living room. The package still arrives and gets processed by me the same way. But the dynamics of that delivery and the amount that I can process, vastly different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was an unstructured ramble.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I'm loving it.
No. I mean, that's definitely top of mind, in some of the use cases we deal with is, are we, is it bursty? Is it streaming? Is it large data sets that are coming in, one at a time? Or, are they popping up, here are 100 new messages, consume away. Mm-hmm. And watching the autoscaler is you know, how it handles that is one of the things that we are keeping an eye on for sure. And you were involved in some of the auto scaling in Knative, is that correct?
Yes, I was a loudmouth barracker on auto scaling. So probably the biggest thing I did to contribute to auto scaling, it didn't succeed in the end, but I did my best, was to build a simulator for it, like a simulation harness, which I called Scenario. And the idea was that it was slow and expensive and difficult to test the autoscaler in different scenarios, right? You wanted to actually test it, you had to stand up an entire Knative installation, and you had to generate load, and you had to wait however many minutes or, you know, whatever period of time you wanted to test it over. And you had to do this for each of the different scenarios. So it wasn't possible for a developer on their local machine to actually test changes. You had to set up this entire CI infrastructure and wait a long time for feedback on whether you'd made a change that was sensible. So I built Scenario, which essentially wraps just the autoscaler and a few little vestigial pieces poking out the side where it touches Kubernetes, and gives it a simulated traffic, like simulated view of the world. Mm-hmm. So it reads its statistics and they say, oh, these things are happening. You know, this kind of traffic's happening and it's going to these nodes. And what do you do? What are you going to do? Tell me. And then you plot those essentially. So you show you had this little plotting interface where it would show you this is what the traffic pattern was like and this is what the autoscaler did in response. And you could tweak various sort of parameters. You could say, oh, it takes 5 seconds to launch an instance, which launch time turned out to be, without having done any statistical analysis, just eyeballing, turned out to be the most influential factor. That's something I was able to talk about in the book in the autoscaling chapter, is like, one of the best things you can do to help the autoscaler, to tune the autoscaler, is to make your software start quicker.
Mm. It's just that easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
We should definitely have another conversation talking about the simulator, because I think we need to, you know, we need to rejuvenate it and run it again, because I'm not extremely happy with the way the autoscaler behaves, you know, especially under, you know, relatively heavy load and, you know, big spikes. I will look it up, you know, try to run it on our infrastructure.
It got picked up. Some work got done by some Google folks for a while. They were thinking about adapting it for work on the HPA. Mm-hmm. So they have the same problem, right? Like, it takes a long time to run a test to see what the behavior mm-hmm. is. Unfortunately, it didn't sort of come to a conclusion. So it's in an unhealthy state at the moment. I'm not even sure if I can make commits or administer it since it was under the Pivotal domain, but Node Law says you can't fork it.
It's up on GitHub though.
Oh, yes. Okay. Pivotal / Scenario. Okay, great. Scenario is spelled with a K.
We'll put that in the show notes for sure. Knative is approaching 1.0. I think we're at 0.25 right now. I think there's going to be a 0.26 and 1.0 is right over the horizon. Is there, without hurting anybody's feelings, you know, are there things that you think aren't going to be fixed in time for 1.0, or, you know, in hindsight, we should have done it a different way, or is it all sunshine and roses from here on?
I haven't been keeping a close eye for a little while, so I don't feel qualified to answer.
Okay.
So serving is 1.0, but we're working towards, you know, eventing being
eventing had a more tortuous birth. There were more competing visions of what it should be. There are so many ways, so many, you know, names that are similar but different. There's so many different ways of defining how things should fit together, and so many folks who came from different backgrounds. You know, so there were folks who came from, like, oh, we have experience in Google Streaming and we have experience in Google Functions. Those are very different teams and have very different views, it turns out. There were folks who came from like enterprise integration patterns, the EIP world, and they had, you know, strong views of how things should work. And so eventing had a longer road to travel to reach consensus than serving, where we all had broadly similar ideas about what it would look like in the end. There were details we had to work out, the build question, etc. But in terms of, like, the big picture, it was clearer from day one what serving was going to be.
Yeah, and definitely, yeah, it got much faster. So eventing, you know, eventing is getting there, but yeah, it's been difficult a little bit to get, you know, to get consensus on lots of those things.
Is there anything else that you'd like to touch on before we wrap it up today?
Can I swear?
You certainly can. Being Australian, I was surprised we didn't have more swearing.
Yeah, I've been holding it back. I've been good. You never know when a 12-year-old takes an interest in Knative. So what I've been saying to people is look, if you're sick of that shit, Shopify is hiring.
Ah, all right then.
I've been working at Shopify, and I'm sure Trigger Mesh is too.
We certainly are.
I've been working at Shopify for a while. It's been pretty swell. You know, I miss what you might call like the high pivotal days, but I'm happy where I've landed. I'm enjoying the work enormously.
They have a great engineering blog. Shopify.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shopify.engineering.
I think they redid like their. They have a system to make their data warehouse available to their customers, and they re-architected the entire thing on Kafka.
Yeah, there's some really serious heavy engineering that goes on. And Shopify is kind of interesting. It's kind of like the secret giant. Because it in itself, it's not a customer facing brand. It gets underrated compared to its influence on commerce and the internet. And its ability to do heavy lifting for engineering. So I think it's an underrated gem.
And it generates a ton of messages and it has a very easy webhook configuration system. So we were able to get Shopify integrated with Trigger Mesh super easily. So
yeah. Awesome.
Using Knative.
I should hope so.
Yeah.
What's up with the weightlifting? I read something about weightlifting.
For many years I was a competitive weightlifter and also a weightlifting coach. Unfortunately, injury has forced retirement upon me from the sport. So while I do lift weights, I mostly do it just to sort of keep things from falling off.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved it. It was a great experience. I found that, it taught me a lot of lessons about, keeping up with effort over time and, the way that humans can go into a field and discover new layers every day. And this is true of my professional life as well. So the joke I wound up with is that everything in life teaches you about everything in life.
Yeah, that's okay. That's not bad.
That's very true. Now I feel bad about, like with all the COVID lockdowns, I kind of dropped off on my weightlifting. So,
So did I. So don't feel bad.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not alone. I bought some home gear, but it doesn't quite cut it. Going to the gym and working out with Russians. Thank you very much for coming on the show today. I mean, I found it fascinating conversation. Learned a lot about some of the history of Knative and how we got here. If people want to follow up with you and learn more about what you're up to, where should they reach out to you?
Probably the easiest way is through Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find. Jacques_Chester. And that's probably the best place. I tweet sporadically, but I'm there.
But you respond. Yeah. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And we'll talk to you again soon.
No worries. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you for listening to the Cloud Native Application Flows podcast, brought to you by Trigger Mesh. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please tell a friend and give it a review. We'll be back soon with another episode.